1, 2, 1, 2, 3.
From theunz.com, this is the Unz Podcast. Featuring artist interviews, unreleased tracks, and previews of the biggest events in electronic music. Available every week at theunz.com. Hello and welcome to the Unz Podcast. I'm your host, Anand Harsh. Today we close out the second half of my interview with famed hip-hop and indie producer RJD2. He's got 4 studio albums to his name, countless collaborations with underground rappers like LP, Aesop Rock, Blueprint, AC Alone, and more, his own label, RJ's Electrical Connections, and now RJD2 has come out with a new concert video, Live at the Rave. He'll be performing at Camp Bisco 10 this July with Break Science, and this Friday you can catch him in an intimate performance at The Mid in Chicago. Yesterday we discussed his introduction to the hip-hop and battle rap scene in Columbus, Ohio. Today we talk about his early productions, fast forward to last year's release, The Colossus, and he also breaks down Live at the Rave. Today's show is brought to you by Sonic Bloom Festival, taking place June 24th through the 26th at the stunning Shadows Ranch in Georgetown, Colorado. Headliners include Iyoto, Tipper, Mala, Vibe Squad, Random Rab, Zilla, Marty Party, and tons more. Tickets are going like crazy for this 3-day event. Make sure you grab yours at sonicbloomfestival.com. And remember, voting is now open for the DJ at Sonic Bloom contest. Over 50 competitors are battling it out for the last 3 slots on the bill. Voting ends June 3rd. More details at theunz.com. Okay, let's get to the interview. Who were you trying to emulate in these early days? Obviously, you got the MPC out of necessity because you knew you couldn't be a scratch DJ forever. I don't know if you had maybe even developed your artistic vision at this point. Obviously, we have to fast forward to 2002 when your solo album comes out. You had a unique enough style for that album to show up on a ton of people's radars. But in this process between when you first get your MPC and let's call it 98, between then and 2002, what were you listening to? What was sort of turning you on? Like, in the same way that you had to work your way up in the DJ culture, how were you ascending through the production culture?
That's a great, it's a good question and something that I don't touch on often. So what I basically at that point in time, all through I'd say the mid to late 90s up through the early aughts, I had 1 foot in the world of really traditional, quote unquote boom bap hip hop, like mm-hmm. Professor, Premier, Prince Paul, that type of production. And at the same time, I was at times I would sit down and literally try to emulate those guys. And from a technical standpoint, the most difficult guy of those of that world to emulate was Premier, because he had this sort of aberrational style that was just hard to emulate. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I was also listening to, I was always into, funk records and soul, and really one of the things that kind of sucked me in about record collecting even before I was a DJ, or right when I started DJing, was I kind of immediately jumped to this thing of trying to figure out what records, finding the records that were being sampled.
Tracing these songs that you heard back to their roots.
Tracing the sample fodder for my favorite rap songs. Mm-hmm. So that kind of gave me an interest in other types of funk and soul and jazz and fusion. Rock and psychedelic, whatever. And at the same time, I was also interested in this sort of weirdo world of, at the time, there was these labels that were coming out of the UK, like Moax and Skint and Ninja Tune.
Sure.
And there was also, Ohm and a couple, Ubiquity out in California. And these were basically, they're like proto alternative hip hop labels. I don't know what you would call them, but at the end of the day,
it makes sense to the people that understand it.
Yeah. It was like weirdo. Basically what it was instrumental ish hip hop music that was made by guys who, by and large, a lot of them had become disenfranchised with rap. is basically, you know, I know that's a broad generalization and it's not accurate in every instance, but in a lot of the instances, I'm pretty confident that it is. Because I know for a fact, a lot of the people that bought that kind of music, I'd have this conversation all the time between, you know, I don't know, 95 and 2000, where people would say, oh yeah, I love XYZ, I love Mo Wax music because, you know, I used to like rap. I used to like Tribe Called Quest, but then it all got, rap music went, you know, bitches and hoes and money, and then I didn't like the content. So now I just want to hear the beats. So that's why, yeah, I bought these Mo Wax compilations or whatever. You know, I can't tell you how many times I heard that. So, you know, I was interested in that stuff and I liked it, but I also liked the straightforward stuff that, if it is accurate to say that that stuff was, you know, sort of rebelling against, I liked both sides of the coin there. And this is important to, you know, it might sound like I'm belaboring the point, but it's important because the whole concept of my first album, Dead Ringer, comes exactly from that dichotomy. What I wanted to, you know, I felt like the sort of weirdo instrumentally hip hop world, by and large, had this antagonistic viewpoint to things like Biggie or Dre or just anything that was like straightforward sort of mainstream quote unquote rap,
commercial, accessible, etc.
Yeah, and I liked that music. You know, so what basically the concept behind Dead Ringer was to make a quote unquote instrumental hip hop album that would appeal to guys who just wanted to hear the next J. Rue the Damager record, or that liked rap music.
Mm-hmm.
And the track listing of that album, I was very cognizant. You know, I thought about a lot of time went into, I basically saw it as like I was preparing a legal argument. You know what I mean? I made a point of never going more than, you know, five or six songs without A, having a rapper, and B, having something that would kind of driving concepts were to have good rap songs and then have beats that a rapper would want to rap on. So this was another thing that an idea that I ended up carrying through my career, was this idea of take a beat that I think I could sell to a rapper and put it in a context that you can't necessarily rap over. Like, I'd either put spoken word things over it, or I'd do something with it. I'd make it real short, or just be an interlude, or I don't know, something along those lines, but something that was meant to pique the interest of a rapper that wouldn't give a shit about an instrumental album outside of something he could rap over.
I kind of want to blow that idea up a little bit. As a producer, as someone who has a foot in both the rap community and this instrumental hip hop world, how do you know, or when do you decide which path to take? I don't know if you're making beats on demand or anything, but how do you know when you've, say, gone too far and this track can no longer be rapped over? Or do you, from the very beginning, say, I'm making this particular beat for a rapper, or I'm making this particular production for, this is just going to be an instrumental track and I don't have to follow any sort of conventions?
That's a good question, and I really don't know, and
Can you feel yourself stepping over the boundary when you're maybe adding these pieces to these sound collages that you're known for?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. And there's definitely a conscious moment where, you know, and I'm working on something that you could call it like a almost like a like the movie Carrie, like almost a Carrie moment where it's like, okay, I'm gonna dump a bucket of blood on this thing, and that's it. Do it. Here we go. And you're in essence sacrificing something that would function in one world to do this other thing that may or may not work, because you don't really know what world it's going to inhabit. But yeah, it's a conscious thing, and I can't really tell you why why it happens sometimes and why other times it doesn't. Sometimes I'll say, you know what, that's a beat for a rapper. Let me put this on the chopping block. Let me shop this around to somebody, you know, that might want it as an MC. And gosh, I don't really know why.
I figuring out the why or the how of that, I don't know if I can fully have my thumb on it, to be honest.
I imagine it's one of those ethereal things that, like Justice Stewart said about pornography, you know, I can't describe it, but I know it when I see it. You can't describe what's going on to this track, but when you hear it, you say, no, this is an instrumental track, or no, this is definitely a beat for a rapper specifically, and that's where it'll be.
Yeah, yeah. And there's probably, I think that there's also when I look back, I think that that's true, and I think that there's times where I've realized there is no, I can't take this on a detour. There's nothing, you know what I mean? If there isn't an idea there of how to kind of spin it around and flip it on its head and poke it and prod it, then it just stays what it is, and then that's that.
RJD2 with Reality from his 2007 album The Third Hand. So obviously with the success of Since We Last Spoke in 2004, you decided to, you know, take the aesthetic even further. No more sampling. I'm going to play the instruments and even sing on The Third Hand. And then with Colossus, you kind of sort of come at both ways, I imagine. Did you have a sense like, here's the proportion, I'm gonna, you know, sample X amount, and I'm gonna produce essentially live instrumentation tracks for Y amount?
In so many words, yes. What I did when, you know, at the time it got to the Colossus, the only agenda was to have no agenda, basically, you know, and I went into it really just trying to have, you know, there's multiple ways that I had gone about, you know, originating songs. And so I didn't really want to follow a strict format other than just try a little of this and try a little of that. So I ended up cutting a lot of material. So when it comes down to the proportional aspect of what you're saying, that happened more in the track selection. Okay. In the recording, I kind of just let the recordings happen, and it was a natural thing where, you know, if I sat down, sooner or later when you sit down at a keyboard and you're trying to come up with a cool chord progression, that shit just gets boring. You want to do something else. You either want to play a video game or something, but that, you know, when it would get boring or I would just get sick of it, then, you know, coming home, you know, going out and buying an armful of records and trying to make something happen on the MPC was fun, and so on and so forth. You know, so I was just kind of just bouncing, just keeping my attention interested or piqued by whatever I kind of felt like doing at the moment. And I'm cutting a lot of music, and then when it came time to put the album together was where that proportional thing came in.
Sure, sure. I'm glad you mentioned video games. You've licensed so much of your music for commercials and television, and I wonder at this point, do you forget where all your music has gone off to, and you flip on the TV and you hear one of your tracks and say, oh, holy shit, that's me, or do you cringe and turn it off? What is running through your head when that happens?
I do cringe periodically, but I don't lose track of it, because contrary to popular belief, it's really not that much. But, you know, I think what happens is that I've done it kind of regularly over a long period of time, and some of those things end up being high-profile things. I don't ever lose track, but I do cringe, just in the sense that there's times where I just don't want to hear. And it's just weird sometimes. I'm not the kind of guy to sit around and listen to my own music. So there's times where, usually I don't care, but there's times where it's just kind of disarming.
You're just trying to sit down and watch Mad Men, and shit, there's my track for 30 seconds at the beginning of each damn episode.
I'll be honest with you. There's times where I mute it because I just don't want to. Not because I hate it. I just don't want to, you know. I just want to. I'm there to watch the show. I'm not there to think about, you know, whatever. The whole life.
That's going to take you out of 1960s advertising Madison Avenue right there, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I'd like to talk really quickly about your upcoming performance at Camp Biscoe 10 with Break Science. First of all, how did you end up hooking up with Adam Deitch and Borum Lee?
I brought them out. So when I toured for the Colossus, I did four legs on the road, and we had a different opener for each leg. And they were on the list that my booking agent pitched to me. And so they sent me a big list of, you know, potential openers for the whole tour. So I was just going through group and group and group and group and group, and there was, you know, this small handful of stuff that piqued my interest. But when I saw them, I was like, god damn, this guy is a beast. I thought they were awesome, and I thought Adam was just an insanely talented drummer,
and beyond that, a producer as well.
Both of those guys are super super uber talented. So brought him out for a leg of that tour. And it was a few times where, I mean, usually, especially if an opening act does something different than what I do, it's not intimidating. I'm not going to lie. There was times where it was mildly intimidating to go on stage after them, because they would just kill it. But anyway, you know, so that was where we got to know each other. And then actually the tour that they were on, I did this 56-date tour for the Colossus. It was four legs, and I'd do 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off. And I didn't have any days off. Once we would go out, I didn't have any days off. Except for this one leg that Break Science was opening, I had one day off. And the crazy person in the back of my head was like, you should book a gig on your only day off on this 56-date tour, so just so you can say that you didn't take any days off. So we did it, and I set up this kind of pass-through thing in Columbus, Ohio. So we set up just this off-the-cuff thing within like 5 days, and it did good. You know, I did about, I think, 150 or 200 people with virtually no promotion, and, you know, we booked the thing. We decided to do it 5 days before we had the gig or something. So anyway, did this thing, and it was just sort of a loose off-the-cuff, me DJing, him playing along, playing drums. And it was not planned at all. It was very improvisational. And I had the NPC too. And it was just so fun. It was awesome. So when I'm not exactly sure where the idea originated, but, you know, when the Camp Biscoe guys were like, do you want to do a set with Break Science? I was like, of course. Sounds awesome. So, and I've done a thing where I've like sent them out some, like, unreleased and exclusive tracks and like ideas that I'm knocking around for, you know, new album and stuff. So I really think that this is going to be like a special, cool thing. I'm excited for it.
Do you have any idea what sort of material you're going to cover? Break Science material, RJD2 unreleased stuff? Or is it, I mean, do you have the sense that this is going to be really live, really improvisational, you know, just free flowing, and we'll see what happens?
We don't know quite yet. I mean, there's some landmark things that I want to touch on from my catalog, and they are going to open up the set, do a couple of tunes just by themselves. Mm-hmm. but we haven't actually, we don't exactly have a format laid out just yet. And if it ends up being improvisational, you know, I'd like to have that element. You know, I'd like to have some recognizable stuff from my catalog in there, and some improvisational stuff. And I'm sure we're going to be talking about it further and planning it out over the next, you know, 6 weeks or so. But who knows? I mean, the idea of doing an improvisational thing is really appealing to me in the world of, you know, quote unquote, electronic music.
Plans from 2010's The Colossus. Your concert video, Live at the Rave, was recently released on iTunes, and I caught the trailer for that, and did I see hand puppets in there?
Yes, you did. Yeah.
Why the Rave, and certainly why the hand puppets?
Well, and this is one of those things where I feel like if I'm going to give away a part of it, I really need to make the full pitch for the show. Why the Rave was because that was we only got full video of two of the shows on that tour, and the Milwaukee show came out. You know, the footage looks really good and it's really high def, and those guys did a, you know, amazing job editing it, and so
that was the Belmont sessions, I believe.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, okay.
That's the main reason why the thing really ended up, you know, coming to fruition. But in terms of the set, this was easily, without a doubt, the most complicated show I've ever put together in my life. I mean, there was not only was there to explain the hand puppet thing. So what the setup for the show was, for that tour, for that whole tour, was I had three turntables, two mixers, MPC, Serato was just like the digital realm, if you will. Mm-hmm. And then acoustic drum set, guitar, bass, and two keyboard stations, and a full band. And the dynamic would expand and contract over the course of the show. So I'd start out the show just behind the turntables, Samp, MPC, for the first 15-20 minutes or so, and then the, you know, band would come out, and then it would kind of ebb back down to just me in the middle, and then expand back out slowly to the full band again. So there was, you know, I tried to lean as heavily as I could on the dynamic changes of having the band and being able to have the band walk off the stage, basically, you know, in short.
Yeah.
So that was the musical setup. And the NPC thing, at a point in time, I got this idea of, well, actually what happened was, you know,
I at one point in time did did these video game theme song covers in when I toured with that band on a previous tour. And one of the things we'd do would be do the Donkey Kong theme, and I'd load up in the sampler the action noises from when Mario walks around on the NPC.
Sure.
While the keyboard player plays the keyboard part of the thing, and we do this kind of back and forth type of thing where, you know, we switch the parts of the theme and, you know. So anyway, that's where, you know, I put this skin, this decal on the NPC to make it look like a Donkey Kong board, and then I've got the Mario, you know, making hand puppets out of Mario in a barrel just seemed kind of obvious at that point.
Sort of modern day vaudeville puppet show type action going on here.
Yeah, yeah. And then, you know, I've got the projector in the screen, you know, in addition to all the musical shit. So I just switch over to the camera on the video. And what people see is on the big screen behind you, they can see the NPC and the hand puppets and stuff. But not only that, I mean, you can see that was right there a huge amount of preparation. And that wasn't even, you know, the harder part, even beyond that, was that I had to, I didn't have to, but I elected to not only build an outfit, I made an outfit to wear for the beginning and the end of the show that's got, you know, it's a full body suit with a helmet and a wireless mic and a voice, you know, scrambler thing that makes it sound like I it's not me, and a wireless MIDI controlled spinning remote that controls the NPC that I wear around my crotch.
You see it right at the beginning. You look like some sort of frightening space robot.
Yeah. So I had to build all that stuff from scratch, basically out of available materials. So I come out, I start the show in the outfit, and then I disrobe, and then I come back out later in the show again in the outfit. So this was by far the most, and the show is 90 minutes. And then we're also glossing over the fact that I had to, you know, teach a band all these songs and learn all these songs myself and go from playing bass or guitar to singing to, you know, being behind the turntables sampler. It was an amazingly demanding show every night. So this is why, you know, I'm trying to say, like, I need to do the full sell for the show because it really is.
That was an undertaking. Absolutely.
Massive.
Well, we're really excited. The full Live at the Rave is out now on iTunes. We're super excited about the Break Science performance. This is going to be just fun at a Camp Bisco 10. RJ Krohn, thanks so much for being on the UNS podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That concludes my special two-part interview with RJ Krohn. I'd like to thank him once again for being on the program. Remember, RJD2's latest concert video release, Live at the Rave, is available now on iTunes. He'll be at the Mid in Chicago this Friday, and he'll be joining Break Science at this summer's Camp Bisco 10. Next week on the UNS podcast, I welcome in Mickey Kellerman, keyboardist and synthesizer mastermind for Chicago's live electro power trio Future Rock. The band will be throwing it down, as they do each and every year, at the Thursday late night pre-party in the barn at summer camp. Mickey will be joining Willis as part of the New York Hustler Ensemble late Friday, and then Future Rock will return for a late afternoon set on Saturday. More details at summercampfestival.com. Once again, the DJ at Sonic Bloom contest is up and running at theunst.com. We have over 50 finalists for you to choose from, so please be patient as the loading times are a little long. Choose your favorite artist, and the top three finishers after June 3rd will win the last three spots at Sonic Bloom, taking place the last weekend in June in Georgetown, Colorado. Very quickly, we have free tickets to give away for the Polish Ambassador, Borgor, Dr. P, and just added the Blast Off in Central Ohio. And of course, you can still win festival passes to Camp Barefoot 5, Liberate Vermont, the Love Festival in Vegas, and Electric Forest Festival later this summer. Visit theunst.com/contests to sign up. Remember to visit theunst.com for news, artist profiles, and tour dates from across the electronic music spectrum. And go ahead and subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. Write us a review. Tell us what you think of the show. If you have any questions, comments, or complaints about the program, or you'd like to be a guest on the Unz podcast, or you'd like to sponsor an episode, contact me at anand@theunz.com. That's A-N-A-N-D @theunz.com. We'll catch you next week.